Hey, welcome everybody. Welcome back to Coffee with Senshuro for another week, I believe episode 17. I'm here with my colleagues as ever, Zane and Siraj. Good morning to you both. I think good afternoon for Siraj in South Africa, with the fun 2 hour time difference there. So I guess today we're going with a slightly updated formula again. So we'll fire off with a quick news roundup, and then I want to get into a global expansion case study. Not quite as a seven-step structured as Zane's last week, but hopefully still something quite interesting. So I'll just jump into the first one, and I do have a little bit of input from you guys on this first one. So this week, Amazon's web services had a bit of an outage, mostly in North America, but I thought it was quite interesting in the number of things it took down. So that a number of companies like Adobe Spark and so forth had disruptions to their services, but one of the sort of headlines people are going with as well is people's Roombas, the automated vacuums weren't working, and also doorbells. So the Ring doorbells weren't working because they're all internet-based and the servers were down. So that's obviously a good fun title, but just taking a look at it very quickly. So AWS, Amazon Web Services, account for about 13% of Amazon's total revenue, but it accounts for about 52% of its operating income. So it's an absolutely massive chunk of their business, one that people don't really think about unless you're on that sort of side of technology and you're aware of how many websites and servers and so forth are dedicated to Amazon Web Services. Just as a quick little fact on top of it, Slack is also in the news because Salesforce are potentially acquiring them, but Slack are dedicating about $250 million in spend on Amazon Web Services in the next 5 years. Just to give you a scale, that's one company's expenditure. My question for this is, what do you guys think about smart homes with a little bit of disruption to Amazon and all of a sudden your vacuum's not working and you can't ring your own doorbell? Did you guys think that's a problem as we get to a more connected Internet of Things, or does it worry you, or are you like, it'll be down for a little while, but I'll get in eventually?
I must tell you, Ben, I've never ring my own doorbell. I hear the question. No, we recently, a good friend of my wife, her husband is setting up the whole house in this, not Siri, what's the other one? Alexa.
I like that.
Put the lights on and put the alarm on and do all of this thing. I really don't know. I'm just an old fuddy-duddy. I'm okay to stand up and switch the light off. But these are those cases where if something does go wrong and where a monopoly, if Amazon does manage so many different sites and they go down, then a lot of the things go down with it. I don't know. I've got nothing automated in my house. The closest I have is shouting to my son to bring me the remote control or something. That's about it.
Yeah, I don't think it worries me either. I mean, I don't have anything, so I can't really speak from experience. I don't even have an Alexa or a Google Home. I literally get up, press the light switch. But I like the idea of it. And to be honest, I didn't only realize recently, I thought you get smart homes where you have to fully kit it out, but actually you can get light bulbs that are Bluetooth enabled. You just put the bulb into your existing thing. I only just discovered that like last week, which is quite cool. But I think in the past, if your electricity goes or fuse box goes, you're out anyway, unless you find the right switch in the fuse box. If it's worse, you're stuffed, and then you get someone in to fix it. So to AWS outage happens, and then an hour later or half an hour, it's back on. No big deal, right?
Yeah. So I've taken the first steps. I've dipped my toes into it. So I have. She who shall not be named for also being in this room. I don't want to activate her, but Amazon is over in my corner. In my previous flat, I had the light bulb, but I haven't installed it here, so I could just be like, turn on the light in my bedroom, turn it off, which is nice, but I appreciate not essential. You can also get the smart plugs. So they just go into the wall socket, and then whatever you're plugging in goes into that as an intermediary, but it's Wi-Fi connected. So I could also be like, turn this off. So now that we're allowed out for Christmas and allowed to go and create a bubble, we're going to go to my partner's mum's place for Christmas, but we're going to leave the Christmas tree plugged in the main window, and I can set Alexa via the smart plug to turn it off and on at the relative times of the day to make it look like the flat's not empty, which, you know, is a generally a anti-burglar. I don't know how much it'll work. We're on the second floor anyway, but hey.
Although you've just announced to the world that you won't be
all of the
if we can find your address, yeah. The channel audience, you can find
yeah.
Ben's address.
Ignore the Christmas tree, they're not in. So yeah, I've seen, you know, Black Mirror style like episodes or short films of, you know, some guy feeling like he's quite swanky because his door opens with the proximity to his phone, but then the power goes out and he can't get into his house while someone's smugly next door walking in with their physical key. But yeah, I think there's a balancing act which will be interesting.
I must admit, the more as you're speaking, the more I realize the various things that sometimes frustrate me is, if I was cooking, not that I cook that often, but if my hands are busy and I go, you know, switch the kettle on, and it just can switch on by itself, or you know, play some music, and I think that's where it comes in. Perfectly good. You know, it always goes from gimmick. It almost starts as a gimmick and it moves across to becoming essential, you know. Because the same thing you can say about all the apps on your phone. The first couple of apps were games and things. And then it's kind of, yeah, how do you live without Google Maps? Or
why would I take notes on my phone? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's probably that, where, again, those early adopters come in, they test it out. You think they're geeks, and then a few months or years later, all of a sudden it's like, what? You have to put your own light on? It's like,
we're three steps of the technology adoption cycle here. I'll take tech enthusiasts. Zane can be the pragmatist, and then Siraj, you can be the conservative in the market. We're a test right here. Yeah, the two probably biggest use cases for mine are play music and set a timer when I'm cooking. So it's just like, oi, set 10-minute timer, please. And then I go sit down and watch TV or play on my phone or something, and then it'll tell me when to go and check the oven. So, yeah, it's little simple things like that, which are just nice to instantly have some music or something.
How many times have you asked her to tell you a joke?
We've done that a little bit more recently. They're always a bit cheesy.
Should we do it now? Is she there?
Alexa, tell me a joke. Why did the wizard get a job as a cook? Oh, because he was good at sorcery. There you go. Well, it's always on that sort of dad cheesy level, but obviously they never know who's asking. Cool. I'll jump into the next one to move it along a little bit. So AstraZeneca is one of the front runners for a COVID vaccine. There's quite a number going. We've obviously Pfizer got to the market first and Moderna just after that. But their vaccines being in Singapore and Russia, which are having some good results as well. And the one in Singapore is quite a low dose, so they should be able to make more of it. More, the same volume of vaccine will serve more people because it's low dose. But AstraZeneca is one of the front runners because it's using a different type of technology and it can be stored at, I think it's fridge temperature, which makes it a lot more transportable with existing infrastructure and so forth. There's a whole range of benefits. But what I thought was interesting and worth mentioning in the sort of lighthearted way we try to approach news here is that the CEO of AstraZeneca recently spoke to Bloomberg and they're going into another round of trials. They were originally showing 62% efficacy effectiveness in a two-dose process, but then they recently had, if you do a half dose, then a full dose, the vaccine can actually be up to 90% effective. And he recently came out and admitted that the way they discovered that was by accident. They accidentally gave the first dose to someone at half and then the full dose on the second one, and then found out it made the vaccine more effective. So they're going into another round of trials to prove the accident is correct. And they got a big jump in efficacy. So I thought that was just an interesting one, especially with the way that people kind of stumble upon, you know, new technology and so forth. You know, Snapchat, where it started from and got to, same with things like Facebook and, you know, the constant pivots and gaps people find. I thought that was just an interesting bit of information. The UK, just to add on there, thinks that there's a chance we'll be able to get 4 million doses out by the end of the year if some of the approvals go through. The US is a bit more hesitant on it, but in the UK, it was made in conjunction with the Oxford University. So I think we're sort of, you know, going to move quicker on the home ground. So that's good news, hopefully, for us.
It does show that, and I think those tech or the stumble into success probably has been around for as long as we can remember, right? Yeah. If you think of all the way back, so some of the most amazing kind of inventions, and I don't have them off the top of my head, were mistakes.
I think paracetamol was an accident, wasn't it? It was a byproduct or something, the biggest drug in the world, and the guy found it by mistake.
Well, there's another drug that has a different color completely, which was also a byproduct of heart medication. Yeah. I'm told.
Yeah.
A friend said.
Yeah, yeah.
That was actually a byproduct of heart medication.
Yeah. I made sure I jumped in there and took paracetamol before you could take that example, and we're left with the other one. Perfect. So just a couple more quick ones off the top of my head. I thought this was interesting because I had a slightly similar experience myself, but a borough in Ipswich Borough Council, so an area in the UK here, just won an appeal against the council to open up. It's called the Christmas Wonderland. And originally, you know, they were arguing they had to shut down, we're in lockdown 2.0, they're not selling essential items. But one of the differences with this lockdown was that Christmas trees were considered an essential item, or specifically real Christmas trees. So they won the appeal against the council and were able to open up because real Christmas trees are considered an essential purchase. Are you guys out to get real Christmas trees, or are you in the fake reusable category with myself?
Real is always better, mate. Got that authenticity. Get the oxygen flowing in the house, maybe. Is that why they're essential?
I don't know. It's a good question. I didn't double check that, but the government made them essential.
If you ask the kids, it's fully essential, right? I mean, I always found what's essential, because in South Africa, when it was in hard lockdown, it was like only essential services. And I mean, they stopped alcohol sales, they stopped cigarette sales. And I'm sure if you spoke to a smoker or a drinker, they would say that's very essential. You know, it's kind of, how is that not essential? So it's always the funny definition. So the fact that real Christmas trees are essential, I totally get it. And I'm all for that.
Maybe it's not even defining it as essential. Maybe they're just saying it's one of those things you can buy outdoors because people don't sell them in a shop necessarily. You drive by, there's the guy on the side of the road or whatever, or by the fields with all these trees. So they seem to think anything outdoors is all good to go. COVID doesn't hang out outdoors, guys.
Yeah, well, it's specified real, so I don't know, maybe you're right, maybe there's something to that. Interestingly, and part of the reason I found this article interesting was shop in a shopping center over here called The Range, which does a lot of like home care, so you know, you can go and buy kitchenware, lighting, you know, tools, all this sort of stuff, and they have a big Christmas section. It was open during this lockdown because they put a small section of the shop in as Iceland, which over here is a food shopping place normally set off by itself. So just over in the corner, they had a food section where you could buy food, therefore essential, therefore the whole shop is open. So for 1/10 of the shop in the corner being a food section, they had the rest of it. And I would say I went there. I was a part of it. I would say 80% of people were just shopping for Christmas lights, trees, all sorts of things. I think I saw one or two people that grabbed some food because it was convenient on the way to the checkout. That's what I thought was interesting about the way that lockdown 2.0 and people are getting around the essentialness of shopping.
Adapt, find those loopholes.
I know. I mean, speaking of adapting, as we are, we're so good at segues. Obviously, we're at the point of recording this, we're in Black Friday, and Christmas shopping is obviously becoming quite a big thing, especially as we're about to, again, come out of lockdown. But a really common growing trend is obviously popping up, and that is robots, retail robots, scanning and buying out all the Christmas deals for people who want to then make a profit off this new sold out item before consumers like you and I can sort of buy it. So it's becoming more and more. So a good example of this is the PlayStation 5 is out of stock, but you can find it on eBay for about £5,000. I think it's meant to sell for £500. Same with the Xbox Series X, which just came out. And they're contributing a lot of this to people setting up robots to buy it the second it becomes available, and then they can go and resell it. So this is really popular in the sneaker, in the vintage and for people like sneakerheads, also doing this when new sneakers come out. One of a big example of it, the launch of NVIDIA's PC gaming graphics card was the biggest case. It was sold out in less than a second, and they reckon only a handful of people were actually able to buy it in that amount of time. So these Black Friday and Christmas deals are just disappearing. I've got a quote here from a director of international e-commerce. It was for the retailer GameStop. And he said at any time, about 60% of their traffic, and they had hundreds of millions of visitors, would be bots or scrapers just checking the website for deals. Some of them just notify the user of when something goes on sale, and then some of them are sophisticated enough to automatically buy the item and check out on the websites. And then so the really interesting thing here, and I want to get your thoughts on it, and this will sum up the news section, was this director was in two minds. He said, on one hand, you just need to shift the product, right? So as the seller, you're like, it doesn't matter if I sell to a bot or a real customer. I've sold all of my product in less than an hour. That's fantastic. But on the flip side, obviously, if your real customers can't get the product, they're going to go somewhere else. They're going to have a bad user experience. Your product then starts being sold on eBay and so forth for 10 times the value, and that becomes part of, you know, affects your brand. Do you guys think if you were selling something like this, you'd be worried about robots? Have you missed out on any great sales that might have been stolen from robots?
Yeah, I don't like the idea of this robot thing. I get the concept, you know, of here's a product, supply and demand. If I get a hold of this and if people want it, I can make a profit off of it. Fine, if you buy one or two and, you know, you leave it at that. But with the bots, again, that's an interesting point you made about the brands. I was thinking more from the consumer side, but obviously for a brand's perspective, that would be an issue. If the genuine people who like your product can't get a hold of it, then you're not going to, like you said, it's a bad user experience. So I used to work for the Brit Awards. So they're the UK equivalent of the Grammys. And one of the problems we had was when we sold tickets, most of the tickets weren't sold to the public, and then the top tier, so it's at the O2, and the top tier of the O2 was either given to corporate clients or to the public. And a lot that we had the same thing, bots. It would normally be these ticket resale sites. I don't think we had proof necessarily, but they would always pop up on these resale sites, and they wouldn't be the exact seat number. So you couldn't figure out it's that seat, let's invalidate that ticket, that barcode, and get a new one. So that was a big problem. It was against the terms and conditions. You can't resell it when it's not for profit. The Brits is also for, you know, charitable reasons. So some of that money goes into trust, various trusts and things. So it is a big issue. And these sorts of people taking advantage, I guess it's just another form of you could almost argue it's cybercrime in a way.
Mm. Yeah, because I think from a brand perspective, the being sold out is both a positive and a negative, right? So positive that I'm sold out, negative that I didn't understand the market demand high enough. And then therefore I look bad, and because the longer you wait and someone might go for an alternative, and there's all these reasons why you don't want to be out of stock at any particular time. And it just totally screws it up. it does mess it up completely. Again, the various things we have to now consider when the new problems that digital kind of brings with it. We often think that digital is going to reduce the jobs, but all it does is create other jobs, doesn't it? It just creates, now we need people to watch this and develop other things to counteract that. I mean, Zen, I know you're a big sports fan, and you with the Cricket World Cup and the
soccer. That was the worst.
I mean, you actually have to go there and like pitch for your, like you have to put a bid in and hope you get a lucky draw, and then you get two tickets here and one ticket there, and it just becomes this total nightmare. And
yeah, I remember.
The more bots are in play, the harder it is then to do competitions, to do entries into things. I think it's we need to get a hold of it and see how we're going to combat that.
It'll be exciting because it's a bit like an arms race where each person has to up their game, right? So someone will create an AI that goes, it's impossible for a human to hit that sell button within 0.5 of a second. Therefore, this is a bot. Therefore, don't sell to them. And then the bots will get smarter and start like intentionally going off human reaction speeds and like optimizing to be like, all right, they've set the number to 1.2 is the fastest a human can move. Therefore, I'll move at 1.21 and I'll still beat the human. It'll be interesting to see how, and you know, obviously e-commerce is becoming a massive part of it. Black Friday, Christmas shopping. It'd be really interesting. And I think, like, to your point, some brands rely on the exclusivity. Like, that's part of it. It's like you can't get Yeezy sneakers within an hour of it going out, but that's what props up their value. And then there's an entire aftermarket of sneakers where shoes become really valuable based off their demand and so forth.
This is a solution, but what about – so I remember vaguely when I was about 10 years old, so we're looking at, like, two decades ago – when DVDs were a thing and they came out. I remember Woolworths, before it shut down, I don't know if that was outside the UK, but they closed. But I think I wanted the X-Men DVD, or I don't know which DVD it was. And you had to go in, they were like, it's coming out in a month, you pay a £5 deposit now, and when it comes out, you'll be the first one to get it. So I don't know if a solution is people sign up for a pre-sale online, you submit your email address, you get maximum number shipped to that or sold to that email address, and it builds up hype as well. So I don't know, maybe that could be a solution, but bots will probably get around that as well.
I think one thing they'll start doing is like limiting sales to customers, but then the bots just have to be able to create different accounts and cycle through those accounts. So you literally just create customer1@gmail.com, customer2, and then cycle through. And that's what I think. It'll just be a fun arms race of who can outdo the other one and then create a countermeasure and so forth. That's my news roundup for the week and for today. Hopefully that was a bit interesting as well as informal. There's a lot of interesting things going on in the world, so I tried to make it fun. What I'm going to do now is jump to today's global expansion case study, as we've sort of been doing. So I wanted to take a look at a company, and I know we did a few fails in a row, so I wanted to look at a success. And who I've looked at today is the largest restaurant in the world, large restaurant chain, and we're going to look at McDonald's, because they've been very successful at expanding into more than 100 countries around the world. They've got about I think it's over 37,000 locations. They employ like 1.9 million people or something. And one interesting stat is there's a McDonald's in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba for the US. It's the only one in there. It's only accessible to US military personnel, but again, must be essential shopping to have made it in there. So I wanted to take a look at a couple of the strategies. It's a fairly focused case on how they adapt. There were some really interesting things when I was doing the research into, you know, they take a look at some local architecture, and they build McDonald's in really interesting locations that are important to the country and to the culture and so forth. But that's a whole another thing to jump into. So lots of interesting parts, but we're going to jump in. So they kind of have two steps to their adoption, to their strategy when they're entering into a market. So one step is to go with a standardization strategy. So this is two parts. They kind of go hand in hand. So anywhere a McDonald's operates, they offer a set menu. So, you know, your McFlurries, your McNuggets, your McChickens, your Happy Meals, these are consistent across any McDonald's. If I go to McDonald's in Singapore or I go to McDonald's over here, I can get myself a Happy Meal. That's a really important part of the brand strategy. One, it builds economies of scale. They don't have to come up with new menus. They don't have to come up with new items. Well, they do, and we'll get to that. But these items are consistent. They know how to produce them. They know how to do it fast. They can set up really quickly into a location. So standardization is one thing. And I think what else it brings of value is And I think it's what makes chains a really big success is you kind of know what you're getting. So if I go over to Indonesia or somewhere, I know I can walk into a McDonald's and get what I expect. I think when the last time I was in Bali, we did do that. We were eating a lot of local food, but at some point after about a week, we just wanted something that, you know, kind of tasted like home, to put it one way, or to taste something a bit regular. So we ended up going into a McDonald's. I think we even commented that we felt bad we were having McDonald's while on this amazing holiday, but we just needed that moment of normalcy in our diet. So, you know, there's that benefit there. I guess let's chuck it to you guys for a second on this first step. Do you think that's value? Do you find yourself going to McDonald's in other countries and going, oh, great, I really need a Big Mac?
It's an interesting one. So, I mean, I love to travel. I've been to over 50 countries and I like to try the different cuisines everywhere I go. But when I was about 19, maybe 20, it was the first time I'd ever traveled anywhere by myself. So I got an internship at a law firm in Beijing. And a lot of Europe is quite similar. There's so many differences, but it's a similar feel. China was a big culture shock. So the first week, I was there for a month, first week or two, I tried as many different restaurants as I could, different Chinese food, went to the food market. And then I told them I didn't eat meat. So I went into a restaurant and I was like, they didn't really understand English. So I was like, can I just have a, let's just play it safe. I'll go for a soup. The soup came, you know, these weird balls in it. And I was like, what the heck is this? I was still happy to try it, tried it. It was the chewy, I couldn't even bite through it, couldn't even chew it. It was so chewy. And then like pus was coming out of something, some weird liquid. I was like, oh my God, I can't even swallow this. And it turned out that they were eyeballs, like some sort of seafood, like some sort of, I don't know what it was, what creature it was. And after those 10 days, I was like, I think I went to McDonald's every day for at least 8-9 days straight, getting my fish fillet chips. Yeah. I was like, forget that.
Yeah, I've done exactly what you did, Ben, which is we were in Phuket and also, you know, eating the most amazing Thai food. And then you get to a point where it's like, maybe I should just have a McDonald's. And it is, yeah, it is that kind of just the normalcy. But I think from a strategy point of view, just quickly, is that, you know, the standardization is what it's all about to a certain extent, because if you think about scaling, you scale processes and you scale things that are standardized. And I think that's what if anything is too customized to themselves. So my brother-in-law he makes food and he calls himself the Chubby Chef, which is fantastic. And I love the name. But his food is amazing, but it can never be replicated because he is the Chubby Chef, right? The whole brand looks like him and it's kind of there. You can't really replicate that, or it's going to be very difficult to do. And that's what places like McDonald's and KFC do really well, is like, we know the standard, we know exactly how it is. The machines cook at a certain rate, and there's a complete blueprint for a kind of, you just go, that's what it is, and you just, it's the quintessential scaling at mass, which they do really, really well, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. And you know, we see this across the board. We talked about Starbucks failing to adapt to the Australian market, but on some level there needs to be a foundation of standardization there. We know what type of coffee we're going to get when we go to Starbucks. We know we're going to get our pumpkin spice latte at Halloween and so forth. And that becomes part of the brand. This is what they're known for. And whether I'm in the US or the UK or Australia, I know at Halloween I'll go and get this, or they'll have a Christmas menu. And I think what that does really well is create a foundation for the business, right? So like you said, this is the blueprint. When we go into a new country, this is what we'll do. And then we start to adapt. So that's where part two comes into this. And that's the adaptation strategy. It's essentially a localization strategy. So what McDonald's does here is they start to adapt to the needs of the consumers based off the culture for the specific countries. And they do this really well. When you go to McDonald's around the world, you will find differences in the menus, differences in the restaurants, and so forth. So what they do is it does increase the need for communication, obviously. So that's a really important part of the globalization strategy. And it does increase the product costs, But that's where the economy of scale with the standardization starts to help cover that and outweigh it. So they quite often go through a big phase of sort of product tests and experimentation. So they'll add items to the menu, remove them if they don't work, try seasonal trends. So they have burgers that are specific to autumn in Japan, and so forth. And they just test it out and see what works and build off that and then start to standardize in that country. So I thought what might be valuable is to look at a specific case of how they've done this. So France had a really good case study for this, and I want to run through it. So they went into the country, I think, in 1979. They did okay, but it wasn't until a little while later, I think around 1995, that they started to adapt to the French clientele, and they really sort of took off from there. So I think in 15 years or so, they doubled the number of restaurants they had in France. But what they had to do was take a look at the French culture. So one of the things they did was they realized that local cheeses, local beef and baguettes might be more appealing to the French palate. So what a stat for France is about 70% of their sandwiches are made on baguettes. So adding baguette sandwiches became appealed to the local customers and then help the restaurants really increase from there. The other thing they started doing was launching the McCafes. So France really loves small coffee shops and that sit down and the relax element as well. So they started launching just sort of McCafes to appeal to that. And one of the final sort of tactical moves that McDonald's started making was they would actually have servers go around to tables and take orders for coffees and desserts and second courses. Because the American market more commonly snacks and goes in for little bits, but this was quite uncommon in France, and people will sit down for, you know, several courses is more of a common way for them to eat. So they were able to greatly increase their spend per patron. I think in the set I had, it went to an average of $15. It doesn't have the American amount, but about four times higher than the American average spend per patron. But by sort of adapting to these ways. Those are some pretty big changes. Obviously, we wouldn't expect to get table service in McDonald's here. And I imagine they probably still have the fast service version as well. Does anything there jump out to you guys as things or surprising? Or I think it was really interesting to understand the differences and the different levels they go to.
I like it. Because as we discussed on the last one with like Starbucks, and you just mentioned it earlier, you know, there's a balance between standardization and adaptation. So obviously people want to know what they're getting, but then if a local market is slightly different, then you do have to adapt. And one of the things for me, from a non-business perspective, just from a traveling perspective, when you go somewhere new, like when I was younger, for example, you'd always see something brand new with food, like even chocolate, or, you know, little things beyond just the scenery and the touristy things. You think that's cool. I think we've gotten to a level now where everything's so globalized. There's so much of the same stuff everywhere. So even going to McDonald's, you think you know what you're getting, you know what your order is, but then you see all these little differences. It makes you think, oh, this is cool. I'm in a, you know, different environment, and it makes the whole experience a bit better. So from an overseas perspective, it's cool. And then from a local perspective, you want to adapt to the market so those people enjoy it and you maximize your sales and experience.
Yeah, I think I didn't realize they actually change almost business models where they get servers and things. I thought you were more going to speak about a particular, like more the palate and the actual menu itself and mm-hmm. adding some more spicy in certain areas or something like that. It's interesting. I think it's really cool. I mean, one of the things that I notice and my son when we've traveled is the differences in Fanta. The drink, that's our favorite drink, right? So Fanta in South Africa is bright orange. I'm talking about it's like as orange as you can get. So it's almost this kind of orange is Fanta here. Whereas in Europe, it's kind of almost a yellow, and the taste, it's just so different, the Fanta. So that's one of our things, running things. If you go into a new country, let's try the different Fantas. And again, it gives you that familiarity, but at the same time, I'm trying something new. Because in the same way as that's the joy of being in a different country, is to feel.
My favorite Fanta was in South Africa. It was a grape. I think it's grape. I can't remember. It's the purple can. We don't have that here. I came home. I looked for everywhere. I'm like, that was the Fanta.
Yeah, Fanta grape. We have Fanta grape and pineapple. And but I've seen.
You should bring some next time you come.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's good. Just interesting. I don't know if you're going more on this, Ben, but just I've you know, in one of the previous episodes, I threw you a curveball when it came to who makes, what is the brand that makes the most tires, and it was Lego, right? And again, you know, you talk about McDonald's as a food or restaurant chain, but they're also the biggest toy manufacturer or supplier. They supply more toys than Toys R Us or any other global brand, because of all the free toys,
the Happy Meals, yeah,
that they're giving away. I don't know if they adapt it for localization. Probably not, but you can imagine a toy supplier kind of going, all right, McDonald's are coming. They need 10 million little minions or whatever, because that's the theme right now. It becomes such a massive, massive kind of market. The toys are essential, absolutely essential.
Yeah, I imagine the toys are standardized, because the Japanese toys won't be the same as the US and so forth. But just to your point of the menu, that is a really big piece of it, as well as the serving technique. So I do have a few of the top examples just to quickly run us through. This is more just to share some interesting information for you guys. So in Germany, because Germans love to eat meat, its burgers contain Nürnberger sausages. Apologies if I get that wrong for all of our German listeners, with the beef. So, the other interesting fact, and this is one element I almost went into, but Germany McDonald's also serve beer. You can just pop in and grab a McBeer with your Big Mac. There's a whole range of places like this, actually, Portugal and a whole number of countries that serve beer in that. Indonesia, obviously they have a big Muslim population, so they adapted the needs of the population there and replaced pork with fish. They're also halal, and they have a lot of rice options as well in Indonesia, so you can get options with rice instead of bread. Like you said, India is a massive market for them. So beef is replaced with chicken. The Maharaja Mac is the local version of the Big Mac. And they also have veggie burgers to account for the big vegetarian population, as well as Michelo Tikka. Morocco has pita bread sandwiches available. They also use a lot more spice, like coriander and cumin, to localize it there. And they have a special menu for Ramadan. And I'm not going to try to pronounce what they call that. I'm sure I'll get it wrong.
I think you should.
it's an F apostrophe T-O-R for tour. I think it's got in bracket end of fasting. So I imagine.
Iftar.
There you go. I told you I'd get it wrong. And the Japanese is the last one. It is very different as well. So they have green tea ice cream. They have rice burgers, seaweed shakers, teriyaki burgers. They have shrimp burgers and shrimp nuggets, milkshake flavored with green tea, and a breakfast menu with hot dogs, mustard, ketchup, and relish. There's quite a good adaptation range. So I think what's really interesting in this case, and it'll change from business to business, right? But I think it becomes about understanding your market. So really, for a restaurant chain, and especially one as big as McDonald's and in the market trying to play in, there are two markets to its customer base, right? The locals and the foreigners. So as we said, we've all been into a McDonald's in different parts around the world. So we have a specific need, and so does the local market. So they found a really good way to have two different segments, but also have it overlap. So if I go to McDonald's in Japan, just for the cultural element, I might try the teriyaki burger as well as get a quarter pounder for later sort of thing. So there's that overlap there. And obviously the local market will probably still be interested in some of the more standardized menu as well. So they've got a good overlap, but they also have a dedicated section for each of the markets. So, you know, that's not going to be the same in technology. You're not going to have a local and a foreign market and so forth. But I think that's a really big part of the market assessment and understanding who you're going to be marketing to and how, and then that sort of starts to determine how you go in. Like with McDonald's, two steps. One, go in with the standard menu, and then two, start testing and adapting to the local market. So you capture both sides of it. So yeah, that was my sort of case study for this week. I don't know if you guys had any other thoughts to sum up a look at McDonald's, one of the most successful international expansion stories there is, I think.
I was going to say, it sounds like we need to go on a world tour. Netflix is watching. We're happy to film a documentary on how McDonald's has adapted their menu.
Nine days straight of it. So.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating, and I think it is the success, because they've got that balance right. That you can't customize everywhere, because then what's the use of it? So
yeah, you're just 1,000 different restaurants at that point.
Correct, a certain balance of standardization, and then followed by the localization. And I think it does add to their success, because they could very well have just taken the exact stock standard and gone everywhere. And then no one would really like it in Morocco, because it would just be bland. It would just be like, this is just bland. Why do I want to? And it's almost Big Brother kind of mentality of, if they hadn't localized it, it's taking the arrogance. And I'm sorry, it's the arrogance of America. It's going to work everywhere, and you just take exactly what I have and put it there. Whereas I think they've got that balance absolutely right, and it goes to their success. Yeah,
they've adapted well as well with in terms of like health concerns. So they had a lot of challenges with people saying, "Oh, it's really unhealthy." Then they introduced the salad. They were like, "Let's reduce the calories in certain, you know, of their menu items." I know they've been banned in a few countries, but it's very few. It's like Iran and Zimbabwe, maybe a couple of others, I'm not sure. But considering how widespread they are, is a magnificent success.
Yeah. And then the other, have you guys heard of the Big Mac Index? It's actually like it's quite a well-renowned financial kind of model.
Standard, yeah.
To get the currency right, because understanding currencies around the world is for me like really tough. It's like, what do things cost, and you know, what does a cup of coffee cost there, and the power of your currency somewhere else. And then it's just kind of, because Big Macs are Big Macs, let's consider what you get. You can actually rate your economy on the Big Mac Index. I love it.
I think that plays into what we were saying with Uber, right? Where you start to become the verb or the adjective people use. If you can get in, dominate the market, and then, you know, I'll Uber somewhere, I'll Google that answer, you know, you become your own index, your own financial global index. I think it's a great point. I think that'll keep us short and sharp today. So guys, thank you so much. I hope that was interesting to you guys, Zane and Siraj, and obviously to everyone listening and watching to understand a bit more of that sort of global strategy. So thanks again for joining in with us. It's been a great session. I really enjoy all of these. We'll look forward to speaking to you next week. Follow us in the usual places, and we'll see you again soon.
Thanks. See you next week. Cool.
Yes.